HWO Radio.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
And welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is the 26th of February 2016. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. And just before we get started today, I just want to say a few thank yous. Just want to say thank you to Angel in the chat room, who's been designing some of the illustrations that you might have seen for our podcasts. He did one for Aryan Insights, and he's done some for the Homeland Report. They're really good, and we really appreciate that. Also want to say thank you to Ben Garland, who maintains our subscription service. Anyone that subscribes to our podcasts, he's the one that uploads them all to that site and maintains it. And I'd also like to say thank you to Andy Greatstory, who has uploaded every single one of our Truth Will Out Radio podcasts up to his YouTube channel. Anyone that wants to do that, they are welcome to. We really appreciate it. Try and get the message out any way that you can. So a big thank you to all three of them. Okay, well, once again, I'm joined today by Mr. Dennis Wise, the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. How are you doing today, Dennis?
Hello, sir. I'm doing fine, thank you very much.
Excellent, that's good to hear.
The world is treating you well.
Yes, it is treating me well. It's a little bit cold, but we won't go into that, what's happened to me tonight. At least I have got some electric heating. And we're also joined by Messerschmitt. How are you doing today, Messerschmitt?
I'm fine, thanks. Still waiting for spring, just as you.
Yeah. Honestly, it almost was spring-like a month or so back. It was still fairly warm here, but now we seem to have taken a bit of a cold turn, and we've had a bit of snow over here, but at least we know that the seasons are still just about working how they should do. And no matter how chaotic it gets with our white world at the moment, the actual natural world around us continues to function as it should do. Today, Schmidt, I believe you're going to go into part two of your presentation on Michael Wittmann that we were hearing about last week. Do you want to do a quick recap of that or go straight into your presentation of part two?
Maybe I could remind the listeners of where we left off. That was that story that we heard where Michael Wittmann took out six enemy tanks, T-34s, with his Stuk 3. Tank, if people remember that. And then I would continue. So the following month after these events, Michael Wittmann was wounded for the first time by shell fragments when his Stuk was hit, and this earned him the wounded badge in black. And in the meantime, he had taken out several more T-34 tanks and anti-tank guns, and this is all at the Eastern Front. And Wittmann would actually consider it more of a coup to take out an anti-tank gun because of their small size. They are more difficult to spot, they are more easily concealed by the enemy, and they can still do considerable damage to a tank, especially if it hits from the side or the tracks especially. And then in October, he was wounded again and promoted to SS Oberscharführer, which translates to senior squad leader, while at the same time being recommended for officer training. On the 21st of November, he was awarded the Panzerkampfabzeichen, or Tank Assault Badge, in silver, for having taken part in 25 heavy engagements with enemy forces. And by this time, the heavy Russian winter had set in and had made life at the front very miserable, aside from the usual horrors of war. And the German advance came to halt in most places at the Eastern Front. But they were able to dig in and resist counterattacks for the most part. Wittmann was then recalled to Germany to attend the Waffen-SS Junkerschule, or officer school, in Bad Tölz in Bavaria. And if you remember, he was born there in Bavaria. The physical and mental training and testing there was probably the most severe of any military school. In addition to physical exercise and training on different weapons, they also had to take courses in etiquette, so they would be impeccable in any social situation or be a perfect gentleman, in other words. The training routines placed great emphasis on camaraderie and cooperation. And as we've heard last time, that was something Michael Wittmann put great emphasis on or enjoyed a lot, the teamwork. A team leader would feel responsible for the team he was commanding, but at the same time feel as part of the team. That is how the SS worked. The officers were undergoing the same hard physical training and mental training, and they would not feel above their men. They would be their superiors in the command structure, but they would consider themselves a vital part of the team, and they would also go into combat with their team. And this is probably one of the reasons why so many SS officers, up to the highest grades, fell alongside their subordinates in battle at the front line. They would not just send them into battle, but go into battle with them. And for some further reading, I would recommend everything General Léon Degrelle wrote about the war at the Eastern Front. He was also an SS man. And he made it from the lowest rank, basically, to the highest rank by achievements on the battlefield. He was actually offered to get an officer's promotion from the start, but he refused. But I'm digressing. So back to Wittmann. His training concluded on the 5th of September of 1942, and he was now a Fähnrich, an officer candidate. He was assigned to the SS Panzer Replacement Battalion in Weimar, where he changed back into the familiar black Panzer uniform. He had worn it already while commanding the armored scout cars, but while he was commanding the Stuk III, the assault gun, which were considered part of a different weapon category, he accordingly wore the field gray uniform of the SS. And on the 21st of December, he was posted at the Heavy Panzer Replacement and Training Battalion 500 at Paderborn with the commissioned rank of SS Untersturmführer, which is equivalent to second lieutenant. And from there, he was transferred to Northern France to begin training on the tank he had only heard rumors about. And this was the Panzerkampfwagen 6, which is better known as the Tiger tank. The Leibstandarte returned to the Eastern Front in January of 1943 as part of the newly created SS Panzer Corps. At first, however, Wittmann was given command not of a Tiger, but a, by this time, rather dated Panzer III, probably because of his experience with the armored scout cars. These Panzer IIIs were used like a shield to provide cover for the Tigers, as they were faster than the Tigers, and thus able to prevent outflanking of the main force. But then, after several weeks following the arrival of 5 new Tigers at the front, he was finally given his own to command. By this stage of the war, the Germans and their allies were virtually always outnumbered in terms of tanks, airplanes, and infantrymen, sometimes by as much as 1-10. The Leibstandarte was often used as a firefighter unit in the sense that they would be sent to collapsing parts of the front to throw back the advancing Soviet armies. In July 1943, the Battle of Kursk took place. It was the largest tank battle in history, with the Germans fielding nearly 3,000 tanks and the Soviets having over 5,000 at this particular place, the area around Kursk. The Soviets also outnumbered them in any other category, having almost 2 million infantry, while the Germans had about 700,000 available. And it was a desperate attempt by the German side to bring together as much force as they possibly could by combining the army groups center and south. But even so, they could only field a fraction of what the Soviets could. And keep in mind, this was not just the Soviet industrial capacity. War material worth over $100 billion in today's money was delivered to the Soviets by the United States during the war, and Germany could simply not keep up with that. For another comparison, the Germans had less than 10,000 artillery and mortar pieces, while the Soviets had over 25,000 at Kursk. At Kursk, however, Wittmann destroyed 30 enemy tanks and 28 anti-tank guns. For a time, he was acting company commander because the commander had been wounded and shortly after his stand-in as well. All this was, however, not enough to earn him the Knight's Cross, which gives an indication of just how much you had to achieve to receive it. To give an impression on how the Leibstandarte and the other units performed at the tank battle of Prokhorovka, which was part of the larger battle of Kursk. At this particular battle, the German side lost 850 men and a total of just 5 panzers, while the Soviets suffered 5,500 killed or wounded and losing 300 tanks. It was not enough, however. From that time onwards, the German soldiers would be almost always on the defensive. So the Battle of Kursk was not decisive in the sense that one side prevailed over the other, but it was the losses were so horrible, even though less compared on the German side, but they just couldn't keep up with the production of tanks, aircraft, and other war material. On the 17th of July, Wittmann and his comrades of the Panzer Corps were redeployed to Italy, but there was little they could do there as the Italians surrendered to the Allies in September of the same year. Wittmann was actually considered to be somewhat of a lone wolf on the battlefield. That was not so when he was with his comrades. He was very well liked, and people describe him as a humble man, a man very easy to like. But on the battlefield, he would often go out alone, as we heard in that first story of how he took out the six Soviet tanks. On the 14th of January 1944, Wittmann was finally awarded the Knight's Cross after having destroyed 88 tanks and countless other vehicles and military equipment. Then, after destroying his 100th tank, Adolf Hitler himself sent him a telegram informing him of having earned the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross and inviting him to Berlin, where he would receive the decoration from his hands. And what was also unusual was that his gunner, Wittmann's gunner, Balthasar Woll, was also to receive the Knight's Cross. So there, in this one tank, there were two Knight's Cross holders. Whenever he could, he would take Woll with him as his gunner, because he had proven himself again and again, and often firing actually without Wittmann's command, with Wittmann approving of this, of course, because in the heat of battle, it's not always possible to have the complete situational awareness and being able to give the precise order at the exact time it is needed. And then again, he went back to the Eastern Front. He was sent back, among other things, to help free the German soldiers surrounded and trapped in the Cherkasy pocket, where actually General Leon Degrelle was fighting at the time. But then he was to leave the Eastern Front for good. In the spring of 1944, he was sent back home to Germany, where he married his fiancée Hildegard, which he had gotten to know in one of his earlier training exercises in Germany. And his gunner Woll, Balthasar Woll, was his best man at the wedding. They had to celebrate their honeymoon in Belgium, where Wittmann was sent next. And then in France, where the Allies had landed and had made progress towards the inland, there was the Battle of Villers-Bocage. And what happened there was that the Whitman had actually only three serviceable Tigers at his command, and the Allies had taken Villers-Bocage, and they were moving to a strategically important hill. And the Germans were not aware of this, however. And Whitman, going on a scout mission with a single Tiger, saw an entire British tank column on the road from Villers-Bocage to that hill. And he later described that this was the most difficult decision for him up until that point, because he knew he had to do something against that British tank column. But of course, he was aware of the odds of him being alone. But he decided to go ahead. He took on the British tank column. He took out the first leading tank, a British medium tank. And that blocked the convoy from proceeding further. And then he drove along the British column and just took out one tank after the other. All in all, 21 British tanks. And he also scattered a British APC battalion that would be armored personnel carriers. For this action, he was awarded the swords to the Knight's Cross. After destroying the column, he actually drove into the village, destroyed more British tanks. No, actually, these are included in these 21, I think. But what happened then was anti-tank gun got the tracks of his Tiger tank, and so he had to abandon the tank. But as he believed it could be recovered, he did not order the destruction of the Tiger, and made his way on foot with his crew back to the nearest German outpost. And he, in his report, he described that he came across several British tanks and could have taken them out if only he had had any sort of field anti-tank weapon for infantry, but they didn't, so he had to leave them alone. And he couldn't take back the village, of course. The British were still there, but a German counterattack followed, and there was a lot of back and forth over this village. And because it was quite important strategically, the Allies did not want to leave it to the Germans, and their solution was to bomb the village to dust with 250 heavy RAF bombers, dropping 1,100 tons of bombs on this small village. So it was never, after that, held by any side, because it was simply not there anymore.
Did that take him out as well?
No, that is not where he died. But I'm going to get to that very shortly now. He was offered to become instructor at the Panzer Training School in Paderborn after the Villers-Bocage battle, the initial one. But he refused, because it would mean to leave his comrades at the front and have a rather safe job back at home in Germany and being an instructor. But he refused. And so on the 8th of August of this year, Whitman and his group of seven Tigers were ambushed by British and Canadian tanks, which scored a direct hit on Whitman's Tiger, igniting the ammunition. And he most likely died instantly. There was actually afterwards a lot of claims about who it was that destroyed Whitman's Tiger, but it seems the most credible theory or story is that it was a British tank. But over time, even Polish tank commanders claimed to have killed him. But it was proven, I think, conclusively, that there were no Polish units in the vicinity that day. He died in battle, but who is to say who was luckier? The ones that had to go into captivity and be tortured or starved to death in Germany, or those that actually died in battle and never had to witness what they did to Germany after the war?
Yeah, you could think that he was lucky in a way. And he died at his post, and he died in his beloved tank after after leading such a full life and doing so much for his country. That's some quite incredible statistics there. When you said that the 80 tanks, was that just in that one run that he took out 80 tanks, or was that the tally right from the start? Was it that just during that one battle he took out 80?
No, during that one battle it was 21 tanks.
No, not that one, but before that, the one before that, the one where he took out...
Oh, loads. The one at the Battle of Kursk.
Yeah.
Now there he took out 30 enemy tanks and 28 anti-tank guns.
Ah, right. That's still a hell of a lot of tanks to take out and to keep going and to survive it. That's quite,
yes, that's incredible.
Quite incredible. That brings it home again. Dennis, you covered the Battle of Kursk in your documentary, didn't you? You see the snow and it really brings it home to you, the reality of the situation when you hear what was going on from inside the tanks and the individual battles. Because we sort of see the outside of it in your documentary, but we don't actually imagine what's going on in their minds and the individual battles themselves. And that must have been incredible. You think hundreds and hundreds of tanks just, facing one another, firing at one another. That's an incredible battle that went on. Do you know anything about where the battle was actually held? There must be lots of waste from this battle still there, I would have thought.
Yeah, prominent point Messerschmitt just mentioned was the fact that the Germans didn't actually lose the battle. In fact, they did kill a lot more of the Soviet tank and armies than the other way around. Yet still, because of the huge manpower that the Russians had, they could quite easily survive that kind of loss. Whereas if the Germans had any significant loss, that are more than twice as hard, 3, 4, 5 times more, because the Russians could simply replace them, and the Germans didn't have that power. And the fact that America sent the billions to keep the Soviets in the war, which I also state in the documentary. I think they got to about 17 miles from the center of Moscow. Not only was that a huge amount of money keeping Stalin afloat, but then the winter came in as well. So there's a lot of things that went on. And that tank battle was just an example of the manpower that the Soviets could call on. I mean, at one point, they even threw them into battle without the rifles. They had to go and run with the people with the rifles. And if the rifle was lost, if the person was shot, the person would pick up that rifle and carry on. Otherwise, of course, the blocking unit was behind you would have killed them anyway. So a lot of this that we didn't know about at one point, and that I found fascinating when I was researching it. Michael Whitman, to me, was the typical handsome and blonde, valiant type German. You know, he personified that image. Wonderful, wonderful guy.
I think 10-1, the odds, 10-1 against them. I would say that was probably in most battles. And yet their determination and drive carried them through because they knew what they were fighting for. They knew the truth of what they were fighting against. And they didn't want to lose what they had.
No. You know,
I don't know if they still do lessons in etiquette, camaraderie at that training. At army training, and that just shows you that they weren't these monsters that they're portrayed to be. Special lessons in how to be polite and etiquette, and I should imagine that would be possibly slightly differ for the different countries that they were involved in that they were fighting it. And you're not going to teach the soldiers etiquette if they're just going to be killing everyone or they're going to be raping and stealing. You're going to teach them that so that they can say, look, we're not after the civilians, we're just trying to liberate this country, or we just want to take this country over to secure it so that the Allies can't use it to launch attacks on us. Yeah, you know, so that just shows you, doesn't it?
Plus, again, the point that Masha mentioned, again, I mentioned it in the documentary, the fact that the officers weren't the usual officer what sat on the hill and watched his men go into war. He was actually there in the middle fighting with them. And I don't think any army unit in the world has ever lost as many officers as what the SS did during World War II. And before they entered a village as well, if they were about to enter a place, they would put a shirt and tie on and make it, you know, presentable to meet these villages they were going in to liberate, you know, in the Ukraine. So a real high tech, you know, high moraled army, to say the least.
I mean, it reminds me of the last one with the Luftwaffe, when they were saying about the pilots and how it was whoever was the best pilot, regardless of rank, whoever was the best pilot, the best at his job, would lead the team. So it was the same thing there with the officers fighting in amongst their team and their platoon and taking the hits along with the fellow fighters and the camaraderie. Hitler was really big on this. I think the camaraderie that he experienced in World War One affected him a lot, and that showed him that when you're fighting out against an enemy, you and it's a life or death situation, you form these bonds with people. And I think national service helped to do that. Even though you weren't fighting to your death, you knew that you were defending your country. You knew you had to. You're training to defend your country, and you knew that you had to rely on the people around you. So there was no room for if you didn't get on with somebody, say you just have to ignore that and try to get on with them, and that would teach people, you know, how to, that would build their character up basically. And when we got rid of national conscription, we lost all of that, and I think we can see that in the countries that still have it. Finland still has national conscription, and look at how strongly nationalistic they are, and the way that they are against the immigration, and they still have this army training. And look at Switzerland again, national conscription, and they still have guns in their homes. So if anything goes off in Switzerland, the Swiss can still defend themselves. So I think it was wrong of us to really get rid of national conscription. Well, thank you very much for bringing that to us, Schmidt. It's fascinating to learn about these people, these heroic German men that fought in this war, because we're never going to get told about them in over here in our history lessons or in the television series or in the Hollywood movies. It's always just going to be portraying them as evil. And we were just discussing something off air that I remember from looking at the old comics. I used to look at old comic books from the 60s, the 70s, maybe even going back to the 50s. And the Germans were never portrayed as being super evil like they are today. They were never gassing Jews or turning them into lampshades and soap. They were always just portrayed as just like us, but a bit bumbling and a bit daft. You know, it would mock them, but it would never make them out to be evil. Yet today, they feel free to just slander the Germans all the time and make them out to be these really evil people. And we were saying, well, maybe that's because the people that were still alive back then are no longer alive now, so they can't speak up and say, well, hang on, this is wrong. And obviously the Jews have controlled everything so much now that the movies, Hollywood, all the propaganda, it's the truth just doesn't get a look in. So I'm really pleased that you come on here to bring the truth to us about these people, Schmidt.
My great pleasure.
Thank you. Dennis, part 16,
yes.
Finally, been released this week.
One of the fastest parts I've ever done, to be honest. And I don't release them easily. So you can imagine, you know, I was more than happy with the result of it, and more than even more happy with the comments it's presently getting, which is great to see, because it's not a subject. A lot of people know about it, but they don't know about it, if you understand what I'm saying. You know, people have heard the word and think it's bad, and rightly it is bad. It's in my eyes, if the devil were ever to make a financial system, then certainly usury will be it. But yeah, highly delighted at how it felt, worked out.
Well, it's banned in the Bible. It's anti-Christian. You say if the devil ever came out with a system, that would be it. Well, he did. It was banned in the Bible right from the start. It's one of the crimes that the Canaanites are accused of is usury. There's a list in the Old Testament, and it lists all these crimes. It says this is what the Canaanites are guilty of. This is why you've been told to exterminate them. So the reason why we've got usury today is from these Canaanites. Of course, the Jews are Canaanites. That's what I believe they can be traced back to. And Marx, you've got in there. Now, this is interesting that you showed Marx and the fact that he never held down a job. He was against all this capitalism. But Marx himself never mentioned usury in his work. He doesn't mention it once. He just tries to make people jealous of the money that these people have got. And this is the difference. Hitler made people aware that the reason why they had that money was through usury. It wasn't just, let's just take the money off these people. It was, we need to fix the system so that nobody can make the money off the back of somebody else like that ever again. And it was illegal for years in Christendom. It was illegal for the first 1,000 years. I mean, in Alfred the Great's law code, it makes usury illegal. And anyone that was caught lending anything out at usury rates, they could stand to lose everything. They could lose their business. They could lose their home. They were not allowed to leave anything in their will to their descendants. It was seen as being as bad as murder, a really serious crime to be involved in, because it takes away the charity, basically. Before we had all these businesses that call themselves charities, they would say, well, the reason why we've got poor people is so that the rich people can be charitable and give to the poor. And if you needed something, you would say, well, I feel sorry for you. Here you are. You can have this. If you can, it would be good if you can pay me back. If you can't, you can't. And most of the time, rich people would get paid back, but they wouldn't expect anything back on top of it. It's like if you give somebody a coat, or lend somebody a coat, you don't expect a coat and a pair of trousers to come back. You just expect the coat to come back. And that's the way things used to be looked at. So this idea of saying, well, I'm going to lend you my coat, but I want a coat and a pair of trousers back, it takes all the kindness and all the decency out of giving somebody something. And some of those shots of Lloyd Blankfein, I mean, doesn't he look evil? Really evil.
Yeah, well, see, it's a double barrel thing as well, because a lot of people out there can't understand the connection between capitalism and communism. And it's explained really well by E. Michael Jones. The fact he uses Shift and Trotsky as an example of how they attacked Russia because it was the only Christian country left. It wasn't for any class thing, that just didn't make sense, but it does make sense from an ethnic point of view because they're both Jews, even though one's rich and one's down and out. So then it goes on, to, as you say, on to a modern-day example, which is that more satanic company, Goldman Sachs, which, as you said, the chairman there, he funded gay marriage. And so that's another example of the rich Jew supporting the revolutionary Jew, because the Jews were always pushing for this gay marriage. So this is how communism and capitalism work together, because they both have the same aim, they're both Jewish. And that's what people couldn't really get their head around, because they're thinking, how can a capitalist get on with a communist? Because two different ends of the scale, and in fact, two sides of the same coin.
And they're both looking to control the people. It's just that with the communism, they claim that it's the people that are controlling the people, but of course it's not. It's Jews at the top, and it's whoever runs the banks that is controlling the people. It's whoever's creating the money that controls the people. Usury creates slavery. I thought that was a really good bit, because it does create slavery, and that's where we get the slaves from. When you couldn't pay your debts in the past, then that was your only way of paying them, was to put yourself into indentured servitude for 6 years and become a slave. So you had all these slaves in the ancient world before Christianity came along. And that makes it clear as well in that episode, Dennis. It shows you that it was the philosophers that had the slaves. These pagan philosophers that people look back to as being these great people, they all had these slaves. And it wasn't until the Christian church came in with these monks that they said, you know, there's great merit in working the land. And they would work the land as farmers. And they would also study. So they would be doing the philosopher side of things, studying and writing the classics and the scriptures and learning and doing the beginnings of what would become science. But at the same time, they were also keeping sheep and fishing and growing crops and feeding the villages around them and teaching the villagers. So it was the Christian faith that actually got rid of this usury system and the idea of having these slaves, and it managed to keep it at bay, as I say, for about the first 1,000 years. And then gradually they started changing the laws. The Pope changed the law. He said, well, it's just for charity. We'll set up this bank and it'll be run on usury, but it won't be usury. It will just be a little bit extra that's needed to cover the admin. But it basically became usury. And that was called the Monte de Pieta. And people did fight against this. The Catholics did fight against this, and Protestants both fought against it. But at the same side, you also had Catholics and Protestants that were for it, that were working with these Jews. And they used the Jews as an excuse. They said, well, the Jews are charging such high interest, such high usury, that we need to have our own moneylenders that are charging less usury. And once they'd done that, that was the slippery slope. But if they hadn't have had the Jews there in the first place, then you would have had proper charity. If people had more than enough, then they were expected to give to the poor. And that's what the poor were there for, so that the rich could be charitable and do a good thing by helping out the poor. And if the poor were deserving, then, you know, they would use what they'd been given to better themselves, and they'd be in a better position the next year, and they would pay back the rich guy. Because you would have a closed society. It wasn't like today, where people would just move to somewhere else if they got into trouble. They had to face up to the people that they were living with. And another bit that really made me think, Dennis, was where it showed you those credit cards, and when credit cards first appeared, and that was during the recession. Now, I remember when we had the crash in, I think it was 2008, and we had this big crash, and they said, oh, the banks have crashed, you know, we're going to tighten up all these restrictions, we're going to stop all these loans. There was the mortgage crisis where they'd given out mortgages to loads of blacks in America, and that had crashed everything. And over here in Britain, they'd all the pension money had gone. They said, we're going to fix all of this, we're going to change all the regulations. And just exactly at that moment when they were saying that, the first payday loans appeared, the adverts on the television. Payday loans, 8,000% interest. I just couldn't believe it. I could not believe what I was seeing. You know, they had never been there before, and there they were. The country's got no money, and we're going to need to tighten up these regulations, but not for the individuals, not for the poor. No, for them, we're going to give them loans and take back 8,000% interest. And I thought that is exactly the same. What you were showing there in that episode when they brought the credit cards out, which was the same thing. People don't have any money. Instead of giving them the money, they say, well, we'll loan you it, and then you can pay back this massive amount on top. In interest. And that interest is never created. Where's that going to come from? The only place that can actually come from is people in the future taking out more loans. That's the only place it can come from. So
yeah, to pay off another loan. That's the problem, because I know numerous people who have debts on a credit card and you know, take another credit card out to pay that debt.
Well, not even them. If you think the money that gets put into circulation, it gets put in there by people taking out loans. You go to the bank, you say, I want a loan for £1,000. The bank then creates a £1,000 credit. That £1,000 credit gets spent into circulation, but the bank then wants another £100 back. But there's no £100 in circulation. There's only that £1,000 in that first loan that's in circulation. So somebody else has to go to the bank take out another £1,000 loan, then you've got your £1,000 in circulation. 100 of that can then go to the first guy that wants to pay his loan off, but then you've only got £900 in circulation and you need to make that back up to £1,000 plus get another 100 for interest. And that's why the economy when you have it based on debt, that's why it has to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Otherwise, you can't pay back the first loans. It's an absolutely crazy system.
The thing is with that episode, right, is like most of my episodes, I try and simplify things. And I'm quite sure anyone who does watch it can understand exactly the system that's been thrown at them or been put over them for all this time. And that's what I think people enjoy about it, because, you know, they can go to their videos, each on different subjects about Jews and communists. And it's laid out simply for them. And when we're I actually wanted to do the Rothschilds at one point. But as soon as I got into this usury thing, I knew it needed, an episode all on its own. It was that important. It was important for people to find out. Just as important it was in the episode when we heard the Jew calling, the Gentiles, even the best of Gentiles, 3 drops of water in a bucket that's not required. Was important. So too is this usury, which is important because it is an enslavement, and it does make millions of people's lives miserable. And the people that are making these lives miserable are these miserable rat bankers and politicians that bail them out whenever. Because these crashes happen every so often, and they do it on purpose. They'll build up the economy. Everyone's happy. Everyone's thinking China is wonderful. They'll be offered loans left, right, and center. Credit cards will come piling through the door, and everybody will just get caught up in all this excitement of a new economy. Go out and buy what you want, even what you don't need, you'll go out and buy. And then suddenly the door shuts, slam bang, and their mortgages are on the line, and other loans are on the line, and bailiffs are coming round. And it's planned. They've done it throughout history. Unbelievable.
Yeah, once it crashes, then these banks, that all they've done, don't forget, all they've done is publish your promise. You took out a promise to pay back a certain amount of money. The bank publishes that promise. The bank doesn't actually give anything of worth. It doesn't actually hand you some gold. It just prints this IOU. Yeah, it just publishes the promise. And then when you fail to pay that back for whatever reason, you can't actually pay it back, then they can move in and they take what does have worth, what does have value. They're moving to take your house. They haven't given up a house worth of value. All they've done is print this promise. But you can't pay it back. They move in there and they take the house, or they take the car, or they take the property. And what you showed, you showed that again in the video, and you showed a very important part of that it's now moved from the bailiffs moving in to take that, which is a civil matter. It's bailiffs. Yep. Banks have now actually got the police turning up to repossess these houses. Now, this is a civil matter.
It's not to break a door down.
Yeah, it's a civil matter. And yet they're using the police as bailiffs now to steal people's homes from them. And this is something that the free man community, or the sovereign community, they talk a lot about this. I used to be quite involved in that. And until I realized that it doesn't matter, you know, race is more important than anything. If our race goes, then it doesn't matter what law or what legal statutes, sure, all of that, that, you know, it's the race that's most important, because all of that comes from the race. If you don't have the white race there, then you're not going to be able to enforce any laws. So you've got to fix that first before we fix the systems of law. So I was very encouraged to see the chap that you featured. What was his name? Patrick Cullinane, who seemed to be well aware, of the Jews' role in this. Well, where did you find him from?
Well, he put a video up a while back, and I put it on the back burner. I was going to use it near the time at one point, but, you know, normally that was with me, like I start on an episode and you know, in lane B, and I end up in lane D. But I always had it on the back burner, and that connected perfectly with what I was doing in this episode. And he's been a victim of this robbery, and he's actually been, I mean, if you see the full video, it was proven right about his battle's been for about 25 years, but the Guardian came out and said he was right. And 13 judges, as I'm talking now, should really be in jail. And he makes a point of that. where he's saying that, that they robbed him of his house, and they robbed several of his clients. You know, he'd over 2,000 clients that he represents. And he says he knows his job that well that when they realize that he's coming into court to defend somebody, the place does shiver. But the fact is he suffered from this very thing himself, a victim of 17 police who had come along supposedly to keep the peace, but ended up jumping on his back, and he ended up in hospital. So it's a fascinating, he's a fascinating guy, he's a fighter to the end. And even more so, I mentioned this as well, because this has always been, I could never really get my own head around this particular thing. When I see a war going on in Ireland for 30 years, and the IRA are fighting the British to clear them out of the country, and yet, after all this time, no one's actually been moved out of the country, and yet the war has been called off, and now you see there's a great photograph of Gerry Adams being greeted by Prince Charles, and they're practically, you know, practically kissing each other because their heads are that close. And like he says, you know, who exactly were the IRA? Were they another false flag? Because they do, these cretins in government do want to keep this revolution going all the time. They always like a war going on. So like he says, you know, it keeps people off balance to come in and rob you. And that's exactly what they do with Ireland. And after 30 years and all them deaths, nothing's changed. Only the fact that you see the Queen shaking hands with Martin McGuinness or Gerry Adams and what they were offered, I have no idea. But something does not sit right with me with that little piece of history. So I may look into that at some point. But yeah, for sure, I love this guy. You know, he's a fighter. He goes on to explain about the Tesco's and the Morrisons, and they have all the car parks, and they're going into all the little towns and all the little villages, one quite near me. And yet what they did to the English businesses was put double yellow lines outside so nobody could park. And consequently, over time, all the shops shut down, they put the rates up, and all the English businesses went broke. And now suddenly you've got these huge corporates like Tesco's and Morrison's who pay pitiful wages. In fact, at one point, Tesco wanted to get people who were on the dole to work for them. It was as close to slavery as you could get, but there was a furore over that, and that never came off. But we all know that Tesco's, who earns millions every year, billions probably, don't pay hardly any tax because Cameron loves them so much. And obviously we know the ethics of Cameron. So at the end of the day, it all gelled well. I was really happy how it gelled to the point where we even had the homeowner who had been evicted talking, because I actually put on at one point, I say that these police and not bailiffs now have come to evict this one parent family. And you might automatically think, oh, maybe, you know, it's in Manchester, it might be a bit rough. But I actually put him on at the end, and he speaks quite eloquently. You know, for a guy who's looking at his, you know, I think he's got two or three daughters, went through a divorce, had a bit of a problem with his house, started off at something like, he was told it was owed 6,000, which he didn't agree with, and that multiplied quite quickly to 76,000. And so he couldn't afford his house, and the police came in and moved everything out. And that video also is up on YouTube. I get all my work mostly from YouTube. And it's fascinating just what's going on in this country, what people do not realise because the main media, mainstream media, just don't report it.
So as you say, the police are supposed to be there to keep the peace, but they're being used as bailiffs. Now, when you say there about the IRA, he's talking about Jews at the time, and he's pointing out that the Jews are the ones that see us as animals. The Jews are the ones that benefit from war. But one of the listeners says, "Oh, it's the English," as if it's the English to blame. This shows something else, that these supposed nationalist organisations like the IRA, they're not nationalists. All they do is hate the English. It's like the Scottish, Scottish National Party. They are defined by the fact that they hate the English. They want to flood Scotland with as many foreigners as possible. They've said this. Sturgeon has said this. The reason why they are siding with Cameron and voting to stay within the EU is because they want to flood the country with foreigners. And again, you've got the members of the IRA saying that they want a multicultural Ireland. anyone can come there. Anyone can emigrate there, but not the English. They just hate the English. And it's not the English that has set this up. It's the Jews that are running the banks. And his, yeah. his audience gets that. His audience understands that. But as soon as he's talking about, you know, the IRA also working for these intelligence services and benefiting from the war, she seems to forget what they're talking about and calls out the English. And I just thought, I noticed that and I just thought, well, come on, you've got to look at these things. The English are persecuted just as much as the Irish, the Welsh and the Scottish by these banks and by these laws. Well, it's not the English making them.
We aren't due funding. Cromwell wouldn't have been there. Fair enough, he massacred quite a lot of Irish over there, but he wouldn't have been there if it weren't for the Jews.
Well, that's it. That's just it. Cromwell was funded by the Jews. The laws that we had, our common law, Alfred the Great wrote it down. And what he did, he compiled the laws of his predecessors, his Saxon predecessors, and also his Celtic predecessors. Because when the Saxons came to Britain, they kept the same laws. They kept the laws that we already had, our common law. And a part of that was no usury. You couldn't have usury. These laws were Christian laws, and we had them right up until William the Norman came in and brought the Jews with him. And people rebelled against these Jews. They got rid of them in 1290. But then when Oliver Cromwell came in with his revolution, funded with Jewish money, where they killed the king, then they brought the Jews back in, gave them the Bank of England, and from then you've seen this persecution of the Irish and these wars against the Irish, wars which the Jews make money from. They're going to lend money to the English and the monarchists to go in and fight the Irish, and they're going to lend money to the Irish to buy weapons to fight the English, and they're going to make the money from this. And they're the ones that profit from this.
The Western countries expel from. Over the last few hundred years, which is quite a number, if you notice, the scroll.
Well, that really brings it home when you see that.
He Macron says, you have this word anti-Semitic, when really the real reason they were booted out of all these places were because of their activity. And usually, it's not decadent, it's got to do with usury.
Well, he also highlights the fact that it's Talmudic law that we're living under. We're not living under Christian law. It's Talmudic law. And it just democracy itself is Talmudic. The Talmud is basically rabbis arguing among themselves and then coming to agreements of ways that they can get around the laws that are in the Old Testament. So they're having a consensus vote. Yeah, they have a consensus vote and they say, well, that's what the law's going to be. It doesn't come from God. It comes from these rabbis having a consensus vote. And that's exactly what democracy is. It's a consensus vote. It doesn't matter what the truth is. We'll just take the consensus. If the majority think this, then that's what the truth is, which isn't the truth.
They're manipulated quite easily.
Oh, you look back to what we've seen, Pharisees and Sadducees, left and right. Yeah. You've got these two different groups. The only nationalists back then were the Essenes, and they left Jerusalem. They said, we don't want nothing to do with it. We're going to move out of Jerusalem, and we're just going to have Judahites. We don't want any of you mongrelized Jews in with us. And that's what these Essenes were, and they followed the Old Testament. Whereas in Jerusalem, you had these Pharisees and these Sadducees. They were running things, deciding the law. They didn't even write the Talmud down until the 6th century. 6 centuries after Christ, that's when they wrote down the Talmud, which is basically how to take over the world, how to infiltrate the societies of the Goyim and rip them off and rob them and steal from them and lie to them. And that's what these are the people we've got in our justice system. Sorry, Dennis, I missed that.
No, sorry, I was saying it says a lot when Christ gets violent for the only time in the gospel. Throwing out the money users, money lenders from the temple.
He turned the tables. Turned the tables on them, didn't he? I just thought the other day, that's got to be where that phrase comes from. Turned the tables on them.
Yeah, turn the tables, yeah. Could well be.
He did turn the tables on them. I mean, Christ was against these money changers. The Old Testament is really strict that's a really heinous sin. It's a weapon of war. That you use on your enemies. That's what it is. It's not for use on your own people. And we've had this usury system now.
The to give me 15 quid back.
No.
I'm expecting to damage to me. If you've got it, you know, there's your tenner back.
And they did. They had a system. They had a system for investments. If people gave out an investment, which was like a loan, then whatever the profits were going to be, they could say, right, we'll go 2/3 and 1/3 on the profits. But if we lose this shipment, if it capsizes and it's all lost to the sea, you don't have to pay me back that money because we've both lost. It's an act of God. We've obviously done something wrong in our lives to have had such bad luck. You know, we need to be changing the way we do things because they used to look at everything. If they had bad luck or something bad happened to them, they would say, well, you know, we've got to change our behavior. We've been chastened by God. But there was no insurance. That's part of the usury scam as well. Insurance, betting on what's going to happen in the future. So you would still make money, but it would be even. Because if you only made £20 in profits, it was only £20 that was going to be split 2/3 by 1/3. Whereas today, the bank will say, well, I'll loan you that money. You have to pay me that back, even if everything, you know, if you can't pay it back. Like what's happening with these people who can't pay the mortgages and the police go in there and steal the house. That could never have happened in the past. If someone lent you the money to buy a house and you were unable to pay it back, they wouldn't be able to take the house off you. They just wouldn't be able to do that.
In Germany, you know, when Hitler took over, he handed the houses back to these people that the Jews had stolen from them. And, you know, and the farmers, again, they got the rights to hand the farms down to the children, which the Jews had taken away. And this is all this kind of thing, which is happening all over the world, especially in England. You know, people didn't realise that this is what the Germans were fighting against. They knew exactly what the situation was.
Well, yeah, the whole of National Socialism was based on being against usury. There's a Gottfried Feder wrote this book about the dangers of usury. The 25 principles of National Socialism talk about usury and how it's at the root of all evil. And it was, as I say, it was against Christian law. And also in Christian law was the fact that you couldn't sell your home. That had to be handed down to your descendants. And again, written into Alfred the Great's laws, which is in the 9th century, written into those laws, it says you can't sell your home, you can't sell your land. That has to be passed on to your descendants. And that's based on the Old Testament. And sure enough, Adolf Hitler, when he comes into power, as you say, starts giving the lands back that the Jews have taken away, giving it back to the farmers and saying, and they wrote it into law that these farms couldn't be sold. Because how can you sell the land? How can you sell part of your homeland to someone else?
Yeah,
that's not yours to sell. That if you've got that, that's in your family. That's for your descendants. It's not for you to sell. You should not be able to use that as collateral in a loan. And we never used to think of doing that. It wasn't until the Jews came over and started making these loans that people couldn't pay back because there's no interest in the system. That's what caused that. And that was the whole point of doing it. They hope that you can't pay it back because then they have the excuse to take it.
That's why they left it. Exactly.
Yeah. They have the excuse then to take the real property.
There was actually a phrase that was often used in National Socialist Germany called blood and soil, Blut und Boden, to stress the importance of the connection of the man, the German man, and the soil he was working.
Sure.
Well, it is. It's at the root of everything. But we're beginning to get near the end of the podcast now, Dennis. So I'll say thank you very much for coming on, Messerschmitt. Thank you very much again for coming on, Dennis. We'll be back next week. Of course, check out Dennis's websites. Just remind people again what they are quickly, Dennis.
MinisterRitual.tv and ComingsBackDoor.tv or come and visit me on YouTube, Dennis Weiss Channel.
And we'll be back next week at the same time. Thank you very much for listening.
too.